But first, let us ponder the rot. I know that you feel, dear listeners, that the system's broken and political standards are falling, politicians all on the take, etc. And on the weekend, famously, the Speaker of our House of Reps, Bronny, resigned because of the Choppergate scandal and the use of parliamentary entitlements. And as you've heard on the news, Labour front bencher Tony Burke's are backpedalling furiously, having charged, perhaps overcharged, for his kids to journey at Uluru. Now, there's been some very common images in the political cartoons of recent weeks, with potties being represented as little piglets feeding at the trough of the political system. But, ladies and gentlemen, 'twas ever thus. The good old days never existed. In fact, my next guest is about to reveal that another Speaker of the House was caught rorting as early as 1695. Mark Knights is Professor of History at the University of Warwick in the UK and is currently writing a book about corruption in Britain and its colonies from the 16th century to the 19th. Incidentally, Mark runs a brilliant blog called Corruption Then and Now, which looks at older political scandals and compares them with contemporary ones. Mark joins us from his home in the UK via phone. Oh no, I think it's via Skype. Welcome to our little wireless program, Mark.
Thanks very much.
Tell us about Sir John Trevor.
Well, Sir John Trevor was accused in 1695 of accepting 1,000 guineas, which was a very large sum in those days, for seeing some legislation through the House of Commons. And he was accused by his enemies of taking bribes to get legislation passed, and he was booted out of the House of Commons. I have to say that I don't know too much about the goings on in Australia, but in the British context that was surrounding Trevor, he was partly a victim of political faction. This occurred in 1695, just at the time when political parties in Britain were really flexing their muscles. They had only just been formed, so the Whigs and the Tories, who were to sling it out against one another for the next couple of hundred years, had just emerged. And so this was at the height of partisan passions. And in a sense, the charge of bribery and corruption was used against Trevor as a political tool to bring him down, because obviously the charge of corruption delegitimizes a politician, and therefore it was easier to remove him. So he was part of a larger campaign that was going on by one of the parties to essentially remove key politicians, and that included Trevor.
Mark, you write bemusingly and amusingly on the body politic and corruption as a disease. Can you just do a riff on that?
Yeah. So in the pre-modern period, corruption was often seen as something which was organic, which was affecting the body. And the way in which contemporaries thought about their society and the politics at the time was that this was an organic process, that politics and the political society was a body. So we still now talk about the body politic, and therefore corruption was a disease which affected the body politic. And again, politicians even today talk about the cancer of corruption as though it is something which gnaws away at the vitals of the political body. An alternative way of conceptualizing that was to talk about other organic organisms like the trees. You could have diseased trees as symbolizing corruption as well.
Another key about the system in the more recent 17th and 18th centuries is the feeling that politicians and public servants were in it for the money. There seemed to be, quote, undue access to central resources, money being turned on like a tap for those with the right access.
Yes. Well, there was a lot of the graphic satire, the equivalent of our comics and satires now, which pilloried politicians, particularly in the second half of the 18th century, for simply taxing people too much and having their noses in the trough so you could turn on the tap of taxation, provide vast amounts of resources for the government, and then lots of greedy politicians and administrators would have their noses in the trough. And that became a very common way of attacking the political system in the late 18th and into the 19th century. And of course, it built up into a real head of steam. And so that in 1832, finally, there was a measure of parliamentary reform, which tried to restructure the way in which elections took place in Britain. And that was part of a much larger reform process that then took place. So you could argue that actually, all that animosity against politicians, although it had a sort of destructive element to it, also had a constructive one, in that it did actually provide impetus and momentum behind a reform process.
I'm talking to Mark Knights, Professor of History at University of Warwick. I commute vast distances, Mark, between Sydney and the bush, and I fill in the hours of darkness by listening to recorded books. And recently I've been re-listening to Kenneth Branagh, reading Pepys' diaries, which, apart from the fact that they're brilliant and he does it so well, give us a very interesting insight into the very issues we're talking about. The attitude that a prominent public servant like Pepys had towards, shall we say, additional payments.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, Pepys was a very important administrator of the Navy in the 1660s and in the 1670s. And his diary gives us an unparalleled insight, because he's so honest about what he did and about what he thought.
Well, he was honest in his diaries, and of course he's even honest to a large extent about his sex activities, but he wrote those parts in code, whereas his financial ambiguity, shall we say, are loud and clear.
They were indeed, but he's also interesting because he doesn't see himself as corrupt. When we read the diary, we see a man who actually can legitimize the fees and perquisites, as he calls them, or the presents and the gifts, we would call them bribes now, that he was receiving. He can legitimize all that in his own mind.
But so can politicians today. We've been deafened by those sort of arguments or protestations of innocence by politicians around this country. But explain, I mean, he was in a pivotal position to influence. Well, he's a naval reformer, he's building boats, he's in an incredibly good position to give favours, isn't he?
He was, absolutely, and he was in charge of ensuring that the Navy got good contracts from the people who supplied it with ships and with all the supplies that were necessary for the sailors. So he's in an amazing position to make money from the contractors who were bidding to the government for those contracts. And he saw the money that those contractors were giving to him as just payments for the work that he was doing for them. He thought that he calls them his friends. And there's this really interesting way in the pre-modern period of how you conceptualize cronies who are doing sort of illicit favors for you as your friends, as though that legitimizes what they're doing. But he also says that I'm getting the best deal as I can for the king. The fact that I benefit a little bit along the way is you know, neither here nor there. What's really important is whether the public interest is being advanced by the things that I do. I guess politicians even now could invoke that sort of justification, whether they think that overall what they're doing for the public service and the public good in some ways mitigates the minor indiscretions that they might have done.
that any politician listening to us, Mark, is now rushing off to buy a Penguin Classics edition of Pete's diaries to see if they can be effectively plagiarised. Now, there was a very interesting trial in the late 18th century, you tell us about, that tried to clarify what constituted corrupt behaviour, and it went on for 8 long years. Why was it so important, and why the hell did it take so long?
So this was the trial of Warren Hastings, who had been governor in India in the 1770s and the early 1780s. British governance in its colonies was perceived to be, by Britons at home, like the philosopher and writer Edmund Burke, as thoroughly corrupt, and what was worse, corrupting when those people came back from their colonial administrations with their pockets loaded and could then corrupt the system back in Britain by buying offices and honours and seats in Parliament and so on. So Burke decided to launch this sort of major assault on Hastings' conduct and to use Parliament as the way to do that. And so there was this enormously long parliamentary trial that started, well, the initial proceedings of it started in 1786, didn't really get going till a year or so later, and then didn't actually conclude until 1795. So it's just this marathon trial in which all the corrupt activities of Hastings are intensely scrutinized, both in Parliament and in public debate. And the interesting thing, I guess, about it is that actually Hastings was acquitted in the end, even though I think probably quite a lot of the evidence points towards him being guilty of at least some of what he was accused of.
I'm not interrupting. I'm just sitting back fascinated.
Partly, I think that sort of reflected fatigue. The public interest when it started was enormous, but by the end of it had waned rather. But I think it also was a way of acknowledging that actually these colonial administrators were being sent to do an incredibly difficult job, that there were all sorts of cultural differences between doing business and administering India than being an administrator back in Britain, and that part of Hastings' argument was actually that those cultural differences are really important and that you have to take account of them. And of course, that's a very familiar argument that we're used to today with business people were trading in countries that do have different cultures of doing business, and perhaps where giving presents and entertaining people who you might do trade with is far more routine than in our own cultures.
And Mark, everyone listening to us is thinking of examples in recent Australian political history regarding bribes for wheat sales in to Iraq, etc., etc. So exactly the same arguments circle around. And of course, besides writing your book on corruption, you're also doing some work for Transparency International on how your early examples of rorting the system are still relevant to understanding what's happening today.
That's right. I mean, I think, you know, there's an awful lot of really interesting political science literature on corruption, and there's a lot of very interesting economic literature on corruption, but there tends not to be a sort of historical perspective, even though there's a lot of historical data that we could learn interesting things from. So one of the things I'm hoping to do is draw some conclusions and some lessons, if you like, from the historical background in Britain and its experience, and its really very long process of grappling with this issue of corruption. It took several hundred years for the ideal of good governance to really emerge in its modern form and to make those available.
Mark, I thank you very much for your time. Mark Knight's Professor of History, University of Warwick. And coming up, perhaps a little bit of music, Doctor Assisted Dying.